I'm Steve Stein, and you're listening to Inside Asia. When I say board of directors, what comes to mind? A faceless huddle of men in dark suits cloistered in quiet contemplation? Or perhaps a more gregarious group of business associates and golf buddies who bandy about big ideas before rubber-stamping decisions and adjourning for dinner? Whatever your impression, the makeup, breadth, and accountability of boards the world over is beginning to change. That's the view of my guest, Stephen Langton. He leads the board and CEO advisory group for Russell Reynolds Associates in Asia Pacific, and he spends his days traveling the region and sitting with boards to assess quality and effectiveness. I spoke to him recently about the increasing demands on boards, both globally and within the region. I kicked off the conversation by asking him to describe the way boards are perceived.
There's a lot of mythology that's been built around this answer. We haven't seen boards. Traditionally, it's been those smoky rooms where the doors close and discussions happen which guide organizations. How do you get onto that board? How do you make decisions from that board? So we've kept it hidden away. And it's been a place where individuals have chosen to finish their careers, go into boardrooms. But now things are changing like never before. In a firm like ours at Russell Reynolds, who've been overseeing and supporting boards, established themselves for the last 50 years, the last 5 years have seen the most significant change in what boards are about.
Is it fair, and I know it'll differ from organization to organization, but to look at it as a closed, dark room of cronies all agreeing basically on the same things and then breaking for dinner?
It was. Perhaps in the past, almost very similar to that. We didn't expect boards to have to be doing the level of scrutiny, the level of disclosure, the level of openness that we do today. The accountability we put on them is no longer just about shareholders and about compliance. They're very, very active members of an organization. And I think the thing that's changed this is the rise of social media, the rise of communities, shareholders, customers, populations that are now informed about decisions that up to this point were hidden.
So no longer can you sit behind those doors. You're exposed whether you like it or not. So the game is you got to play along. You're going to have to open up. You're going to have to be more transparent. Otherwise, your customers and your shareholders will start to become concerned and unnerved.
Very much so. And the media have picked up onto this because the media know this is exciting fodder for the masses who are interested in how business is organized. Up until perhaps 5 years ago, if there was a major crisis with a corporation, an issue of conduct, an issue of performance, it was the CEO and management team that was put in front of the cameras. Now that's changed. Now it's the board that's put in front of the cameras. Where were you? Why weren't you supervising this? What did you miss? And it's moving away from the models that we understood about governance and stewardship. So boards are under extraordinary new pressure, not just because of where they've come from, but because of the ability for people to comment around them.
So who's been calling them out? Has it been shareholders, regulators? Is it the customer who's just armed with a smartphone decides to say something about an organization that he or she is aware of and therefore it reflects poorly on the company? Where are those pressure points?
So there's two ends of the spectrum. At the top end, the most strategic end, is the rise of the activist investor, the activist shareholders. Our firm tracks 42 different funds that just exist as activists. Now, what they are those that are scrutinizing an organization to say, is the most value being achieved from it? They'll look for flaws. They'll look for things that they can do better than the current board. And then they'll take a very large financial position in that company, classically listed companies, that puts them a position on that board. And from there, they're able to say, I can see how to get value that you can't. So that's a very assertive, large, organized version of where's the pressure coming from. But actually, much larger pressure is coming from society. The front page of a newspaper saying, Bank A has been overcharging fees to consumers. And people want social justice. And I think we're going to see far more change coming from the social commentary than the big activist funds.
When it comes to the activist investors, the activist funds, are you talking about hedge funds, mutual fund groups that have decided to really dig just a little bit deeper in terms of information that's available, whether it be publicly available or on the dark web, anything that's available, and then throwing that up in front of the organization to say, we have reason to believe X, challenging them, and if they don't respond appropriately, then taking action?
Yeah, well, they are dedicated organizations. This isn't the hedge funds and the large pension funds. They're not scaled or geared or mandated for that. These are activist funds that keep two of the most effective, most famous, one called Elliott, one called Bramson. They're taking positions because they know and they want active, hands-on decision-making and management, which the pension funds and the hedge funds don't. They're taking a more passive position in them. So this is the arrival of quite assertive, confident decision-making, proven people who are saying, I'm putting money to back my own ability to manage and support you. And its intention is really good. Its intention isn't hostile. It's to say, I can extract more value for your shareholders than you're able to without this approach. In many ways, whilst this is often seen as negative and aggressive, actually it's got a very effective intention behind it.
Or could it be because you see a creeping issue and therefore in order to protect them from themselves, if you will, you flag it, bring it out, bring it to their attention, and therefore they would take action to address it before it becomes a problem?
Absolutely. And this is where we're seeing the change in boards, from the best boards being the ones that can react to something, to the best boards just proactively planning ahead. You don't have to worry about an activist coming in and seeing how to get value if what you're doing is projecting value. Mm. If you're evaluating the constant environment, if you're evaluating your management, if you're evaluating the strategy they're putting up, and you're showing transparently as a board, you are doing that vigilant job. If all those things are there and they're being declared to the market and they're being reported, then activists, they've got less of a play because you're doing your job as a board. And I think this is where we're going to see much more people. It's a thesis called governance premium. If we've got two very similar organizations, why is one of them attracting the investor more than another? Well, it's because the investor says, I'm not sure about the strategy, but I trust that board is asking the questions that I would want them asking.
Steve, until now, what did it take to get on a board? What did you have to do? Who did you have to be? I mean, I know every company has its own dynamics, but generally, what was the process for receiving an offer to join a board?
Well, it's handled this in two ways. One is supply and the other one's demand, of course, in any flow of goods. And before we go into the supply, what kind of executives are going onto boards, the demand's changed. So in the past, boards and the placement of people on boards was almost a function of retirement. We've got a board of 10 people. One of our directors have been here for 10 years. They're about to retire. We need to replace that person. And that's worked for a lot of decades. And so the supply of directors was people actually at a point in the era of their career. I've finished my executive career, my law, my accounting, my professional service. I've been a CEO and now I'm ready to give back with good intention to my board. So you've got this supply of people ready to move into a different era of their career with the concept of retirement churn on boards. And that's changed. Mm. What we've now got is the top boards moving from retirement planning into renewal, which is constantly asking 5 years from now, what does our board need to look like if it's serving the strategy and the stakeholders of this company? And so it's looking for constantly saying, we need specific expertise. Then they're looking in the marketplace for that expertise, not waiting for it to turn up and knock on the door. Two of the boards I'm working with at the moment, big energy companies looking for expertise in the digital e-commerce space. New changing gear for energy companies. All right, we're going to go find them and invite them to be board directors. So the supply and demand's very different, now based on future strategic need, not based on opportunity and availability.
Yeah. On the opposite side, in terms of identifying those next generation board members, there must be some scrutiny on their end too, on two counts. One is a large oil and gas organization approaches somebody who's an expert in the digital economy and they say, what? What do they need with my skills? And I'm not that, and I'm not even close to retirement. And what I know, why would they want to know? So there's probably going to be that disconnect initially. But then there's also the other aspect of, now that they want me across, I'm actually have myself on the line. I am now have fiduciary responsibilities. I'm liable if something goes wrong. That wasn't the case before. So therefore, is it becoming harder than ever before to attract people to boards, or is it still that appeal?
No, it's a really important point that you bring up, which is we've got a two-paced approach to this, and they're slightly out of whack. And one is we've increased the scrutiny, the exposure, the responsibility, the accountability of board directors. But have we supported them with the right protection of liability? Have we made that accountability transparent? What is the delegation of authority between a board and executive? So we're in an interesting period of transition where we're putting vast amount of personal pressure and expectation on board members. And is this is causing people to not choose to go on boards in the future. And I think we're still getting that right. The ability to protect board directors professionally and the ability to demonstrate that future governance is something that people are going to be attracted to, not something that they see as a huge risk for their career.
This is Inside Asia. My guest is Stephen Langton, head of Russell Reynolds Associates Board and CEO Advisory Group. More in a moment.
Inside Asia is supported in part by Black Marketing, the world's most recommended LinkedIn marketing agency, created and led by the world's most recommended LinkedIn marketing masterclass instructor, entrepreneur, and best-selling author, Chris J. Reed. Black Marketing is an award-winning, independent, boutique B2B marketing consultancy that specializes in enabling you to achieve your business objectives through LinkedIn. Learn more at www.blackmarketing.com.
This is Inside Asia, and you're listening to my conversation with Stephen Langton, head of the board and CEO advisory group for the Asia-Pacific region at Russell Reynolds Associates. Let's get back to our conversation about what happens behind closed doors, boardroom doors, that is. Langton says, perhaps surprisingly, that Asia is making a play to lead some of these big changes. He says that across the region, governments, customers, shareholders, and citizens are demanding more from corporations and calling out boards to take the lead and show results.
I think watching the boards and governance regimes of Asia is going to be one of the most important things for the world to see how it's conducted that. Almost every nation in Asia is going through a reflection about new governance, new regime, new transparency, and it's role modeling to the rest of the world. I'll draw attention to, in India, the Kotak reforms of governance. It's probably the biggest impacting change in corporate governance we've seen, certainly in the Western world, certainly in any democracy ever.
Why, Steve? What's going on in India that makes this a unique opportunity to change the rules?
I think it's not just an opportunity to change the rules. It's an opportunity to demonstrate to the world that the corporate competence and capability of India is also matched by world standard in governance, in how it's overseeing that. We tend to forget, it's so easy to forget in the modern era, every board out there is mandated with two tasks. And task one is to provide oversight and support into what the company is doing, strategy, direction, performance. And the other task, equaled, is to provide oversight and direction and support into what way the company is doing it. Now, in the Western world, we became so skewed recently to task two. Boards became like the police force, the internal audit, the internal regulator. Management's made a decision to go forward, and we're here to make sure they do it by the book.
Because they're on to, in order to make sure nothing goes wrong, because they realize the legalities will fall to them.
That's absolutely right. So we've skewed to many economies seeing governance as a form of protection. But also, it's got to be a form of promotion. So I'm admiring a lot of countries, looking at the reforms in governance in China and Hong Kong. India, particularly with the Kotak reforms, looking at world best practice. When they establish 81 changes to governance regime in India, when this has been established and they've got a program of establishing that over a two-year period, this is putting that country into the highest levels of governance worldwide. Look at Australia. Australia is really interesting. 28 years of economic growth. It hasn't had a downturn. It means that it hasn't got any directors sitting on boards that were sitting on boards in the last economic downturn. It hasn't got any executives or CEOs under the age of 54 who are in management roles the last time the economy was in trouble. Big learning. And so, of course, they're recognizing this now and saying, what is the regulatory environment? What is the governance environment that says we're going to be ready if things do change and we're not resting on our laurels? I think with changes in Japan, Sri Lanka, in Malaysia, and particularly, of course, in Singapore, we're seeing at different depths a very clear message of the boards of our nations are going to uphold the integrity of the business ability of our nations.
So they're signaling to the marketplace that we take this seriously, we're going to protect the interests of the shareholders and the communities they serve? Or is it also saying something to the rest of the world that we think that you've overcompensated, we're swinging back into a level of balance, a position of balance that we think is simply healthier? Or is it some combination?
Yeah, I mean, the interesting theme in the changes now going through live as we speak here in Australia, and we're very proud to be part of the team that's helping the rewrite of this, which is the rise of a new phrase. And the new phrase is emerging on most of these reforms, particularly those areas that have had economic difficulties. And the phrase is SLO, Social License to Operate. Gone are the days where the purpose of a board was to uphold one stakeholder group, the shareholders, paid by the shareholders, mandated by the shareholders to oversee their shareholding. And that's now shifting to the board overseeing the rights and the requirements of society on the enterprise that they're sitting the board of. And so people are realizing the 19, 20-year-olds who are going into employment now, who'll be choosing their pension funds for their first salaries to go into, don't want to make choices on the spike of a share price. Mm. They're making choices on their values.
These are conscientious shareholders and customers who are simply holding corporations accountable, and governments seeing this are getting ahead of it and trying to help corporations guide their board selection criteria.
Very much so. In the past, a shareholders meeting for a board may have been 8 to 10 institutional investors in a lunch in a hotel. Yeah, now that looks like 3,000 people in the ballroom of a hotel. Mums and dads, people who've got small stocks. Collectively, their voice is far more powerful than any institutional voice could be.
Is the evolution of boards consistent with the openness of a society?
So it's a very interesting point. I think it's definitely going to start to become reflective of society's needs. Mm. We're certainly seeing this around transparency, around reputation, and particularly what nations stand for. People don't want to know their most successful organizations have cheated. And so I think this really does start coming into a nation's identity of how we seem. Because then investment at the highest strategic level, investors start to be attracted to the concept of a nation. You know, where do I put my banking funds? Do I put my allocation of my pension fund into banks in India or banks in Singapore right now? Yeah. Well, how do I tell the difference? Yeah. But maybe some of it's around which place has the most protection, the most transparency, the most governance that I can see as a shareholder. So I think we're going to get a national identity to some of this governance. We already are.
I guess, Steve, to some degree, it's wonderful to see these reforms, and it's great to see the changes taking place and how it's reflecting a broader requirement that moves beyond just shareholders to society. At the same time, when violations occur, you have to give the nod to the legal system. And it is a question whether or not legal systems can keep up with these reforms sufficient to actually make people feel comfortable that the reforms actually have teeth. I point to India. I mean, India openly acknowledges that, you know, their legal system has delays and issues and problems. Are they getting ahead of themselves? Is this a little bit of window dressing just to let the world know they're serious? But if violations do occur, they won't be able to, you know, maybe follow through with some of the punitive actions that would otherwise need to take place.
So at the backstop, we're going to need a legal system which protects these concepts. We don't have that yet. Almost anywhere in the world. Most of the world's definitions of governance are principles and guidelines for those nations. Only rarely is it turning up in corporations' laws. And so it's a very fine line, the blurring of criminal law, the blurring with corporate law. And it's sitting there as a backstop. But the fact that organizations and nations are trying to close the gap between the legal system to back it up, as well as the imperative to behave in certain ways, I think that's already defended by the fact that individuals in communities, in societies, are voting innocent or guilty every single day on corporations. There only has to be an announcement in the paper of company manufacturing sports shoes in XYZ country is doing it with disregard for the rights of its employees. We don't need lawyers. Mm. When you've got 10,000 people just watch that on their phone, said, I'm never buying that brand again. And this is policing it. So I don't think we'll ever get to a point where the legal regime is going to be more advanced and more brutal than the simple consumer's choices at the end of a phone. Mm. And that's what boards are trying to protect and do the right thing by, the choice of customers and shareholders.
Yeah, you'll be judged by a jury of your customers. This is the mantra.
Yeah, and there's plenty of examples of that happening. Of collective action, of people saying, let's not, on a sense of principle, ever buy from that company again. That they haven't done anything wrong. They haven't been in the courtroom. Doesn't matter.
You know, it's always interesting to me to try to identify these inflection points. Like what triggered this? When did this start to happen? And then, you know, recently I had an interview with a young woman who started something called Green is the New Black, where she's holding the fashion industry accountable for some of their operating behaviors. She points to Burberry and some of the others that burned, you know, huge supplies, backlogs of supplies, and then ended up, you know, being called out and apologizing for it, and then deploying a whole new range of operational disciplines to make sure it never happens again. So we are seeing these voices, these young, you know, socially engaged millennial voices start to say something. Is that what it's going to take, a next generation to push through and start to kind of bubble up from the bottom versus our generation that perhaps is saying, you know, well, as long as I got what I, you know, the product I purchased and it didn't have blow up on me, I'm happy with it. That was good enough.
Yeah. Look, there's two things that seem to drive this. One is we now have a mechanism for doing this. We have Twitters and we have Facebooks and we have phones. And we have everyone has a platform to broadcast. We didn't have that before because I don't think anything's new here. I think we've always had thousands of employees or customers that have been disgruntled with a company, but there wasn't a platform for them to rally to. So that's one side of it. We've got the platform, but I think we've also got the psychology. That people know it's all right. If I invoke Hans Christian Andersen, it's all right to say the emperor's got no clothes on. It's all right for students to say this board's incompetent and be heard. Yeah. And so we've got a bit of anthropology with a bit of technology coming together that we never had before.
Yeah, I think it's that's an interesting moment, and whether or not people will feel empowered to do that as a result of this, it still does speak to the personalities sitting around that boardroom. And you know as well as I that even though you might be identifying board members differently by their levels of expertise, their future thinking, you know, the contribution they can make, there still is the aspect of personality that goes into making a final decision on those board members. And there is kind of an unspoken rule that, you know, in this room, we're together, we figure out things together, and we try not to expose the organization. So it's not like this resolves it, but I guess it just does move the game forward in a more thoughtful fashion. Is that right?
Yeah, but we're recruiting for different things to boards now. It's very clear, certainly for the major clients that are really investing in their boards. A certain element is the directors that are coming on board. Are they competent? Have they got unblemished conduct? Are they able to do the job? But that is dwarfed by find out if they're willing to do the job. Do they have an intrinsic calling to what we're doing here? I don't want to get somebody onto this board if they're just looking for another place in their portfolio. I want someone who's committed to this, who's willing to travel, who's willing to put their name behind it. And so much more is when we've... you know, looking at five or six new board members to join a board, the one that's going to get it is the one that's actually passionately saying, this is important to me. And without that, you know, we've got a board that's actually very keen on being introvert and very keen on hiding from the shadows.
Commensurate with these changes, do you believe that either the term of the board of should be reduced? I think you said it's on average about 12 years now. Or should some of the terms of joining be changed? In other words, should there be adjustments to the way a board member is received, serves out his or her term, and then exited?
Well, this is evolving quite quickly. When I started out doing advice to boards, which was 20 years ago, you'd appoint someone to a board. It was an act of affirmation, an act of recognition, achievement. It was the next era of their career. Well done. You're now in boards. And you'd be appointed to a board with enormous honor. And there you would stay until you chose to retire. And you might be on that board for 12 years or longer. Now, that gradually got replaced with the concept of terms. We'll appoint a director for perhaps, and depending on where you are in the world, but on averages out to be 4 years. We'll appoint you for a term of 4 years. But we kind of like the idea of you being here for three terms. Now, that's where the 12 years comes from. And the reason for three terms, term one, you're on our board learning. Term two, we'd like you to lead one of our subcommittees. Term three, wouldn't it be super to see you as a potential chairman at that point? So we've got this evolving competence. And that served us. Now that's changing again. Now, the reason it served us well is that, and invoking McKinsey's famous, proven three horizons of growth of an organization, perhaps until even 5 years ago, it was assumed that each horizon of growth was the mandate of a different CEO, perhaps the mandate of a different chairman. CEO one handing over horizon two to CEO two. Well, no longer. And now we're seeing boards and CEOs will assume all three horizons in one tenure. Mm-hmm. So what's changing now is saying we could see a board, its requirements of governance change within 4 years. Things that come to mind firsthand to me, major energy company moving within a four-year period from its expertise on the board needing to be upstream oil and gas to its experts to be e-commerce, online distribution, energy markets, retail perhaps. And so now what we're seeing is boards, yes, we're going to see you for a four-year term, but we will renew our vows with you every year. We'll look at performance every year. At the end of each year, are you still relevant? Nothing to do with your performance. Are you still relevant to our strategy? Are you contributing to the collective outcome of the board? Are you adding value to it? And we look much more like a rolling performance review, and the most advanced boards I'm working with are doing exactly that.
So it's just bringing boards into line with the acceleration of the marketplace, the collapsing of time, the introduction of digital disruption and everything and technologies that are bringing into play, and the transformation that's occurring across the world right now. Boards should simply be a reflection of those changes.
Absolutely. And we've never seen such unprecedented demand of organizations to be constantly changing and transforming. The board can't be the slowest entity of that organization to change. It's got to stay relevant. It's got to say, and its demands of its management team to change must be met by its demands of itself to change with that management team. That agility, that intention to scrutinize yourself and say, what got us successful this year might not keep us successful next year.
Steve, is there still a lot of convincing to do? Because, you know, if you look at some of these large conglomerates in Asia or some of these multinationals who've done things the same way for many, many years, many even generations in some cases, you can see the need for change, but actually getting people to shift and do things differently has its challenges. What stands in the way? Is it just culture?
No, I think we're going to come back to the really super old-fashioned constructs. In our experience, where we're seeing boards most address this, most close the gaps, most become the future board they need to be, is expressed through the commitment and the leadership of the chairman. And it always has been that. We're looking at and the right chairman being succession planned into those roles who have a moral courage to lead, who are able to say to their board, this isn't working, who invite scrutiny, who connect to the unhappy shareholder as much as to the happy shareholder. It becomes a very high profile role to be a chairman in the future era, but that leadership is going to be the thing that creates the success. No process, no other mandate or regulatory requirements going to do it, like the behavior of a chairman will.
That was Stephen Langton, head of the board and CEO advisory group at the Asia Pacific region for Russell Reynolds Associates, a global executive search and leadership advisory firm. This brings us to the Asia Insider Minute, that part of the program where I take a few moments to try to summarize the key takeaways from the conversation you just heard and maybe pose a few additional questions of my own. For years now, the drumbeat of change has been reverberating through corporate boardrooms. It started with a call for greater gender diversity, then a push for more transparency and accountability. Every year, PricewaterhouseCoopers releases its director survey, and while corporations pay lip service to greater gender equality, women board members remain woefully underrepresented. It's a telltale sign of how companies know change must come, but remain reluctant to do much, if anything, about it. Finally, a force larger than anything seen before may be breaking down the walls of board intransigence, and it goes by the name of public opinion. Powered by social media, customers and the public at large are having their say on topics once relegated to boardrooms. Activists, advocates, and everyday concerned citizens are leveraging a smartphone and Twitter account to let their views be known. Funny enough, probing or embarrassing questions can be enough to sway corporate directors on matters of strategic or operational importance. It would be wrong to overstate the importance of social media on board decisions. It's still taking root. But it's fair to say that increasingly, board members acknowledge the movement and are preparing for its impact. When polled, corporate directors worldwide say they remain inadequately informed about digital communication risks, cybersecurity, and classified information leaks. Increasingly, companies are recruiting technology specialists onto their boards to counter the threat. But is it enough? If you put all this together, it's easy to get line of sight on how this will improve market responsiveness, profits, and shareholder value. It's less clear if this will all add up to generate improved stakeholder value. Langton says corporations and their boards are increasingly being called to task on the so-called social license to operate, or SLO. But are companies ready to deliver something more than customer value and think in broad terms about environment, community, and the greater social well-being? In real terms, probably not. Taking a haircut on earnings isn't part of the shareholder agenda, at least not now, or not until it's seen as a commercial imperative. If only for a minute, let's imagine a world where boards lead versus react. What if the new agenda put people and the environment first? Would it influence buyer behavior? Would customers follow, or would price remain the prevailing determinant of what one buys? It may be generational. Increasingly, Gen X and Z say they make buying decisions based on the perceived social responsibility of the product manufacturer or service provider. I wish I could say the same about my generation. Maybe we'll all have to die off taking our purchasing power with us before that kind of change drives boards to think more proactively. I'd like to think not. In fact, I prefer to focus on what can be done now to change up and change out board composition, introduce new skill sets, expand the role of female directors, and reshape the principles of operation to include sustainable practices. Baby steps is all it takes, and maybe, just maybe, Asia is in a position to show the way. Steve Langton sees the possibility with the rise of new reforms, government encouragement, and a new breed of enlightened CEO. Finding balance in a new era is what it's all about, and with the combined influence of social media, a new generation of consumer, and a focus on sustainable business practices, there is hope. What's your take? Leave us a comment, download the episode, or better yet, reach us on Twitter, LinkedIn, or Facebook. We want to know what you think, and maybe a board member in your neighborhood wants to know too. We thank you for listening. Until next time, this is Steve Stein saying, coming from the outside on Inside Asia.
Inside Asia is supported in part by Black Marketing, the world's most recommended LinkedIn marketing agency, created and led by the world's most recommended LinkedIn marketing masterclass instructor, entrepreneur, and best-selling author, Chris J. Reed. Black Marketing is an award-winning, independent, boutique B2B marketing consultancy that specializes in enabling you to achieve your business objectives through LinkedIn. Learn more at www.blackmarketing.com.